Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. Today we're going to cover the last book, the last chapter in the book of Kings, 2 Kings chapter 25, verses 1 through 30. This chapter is all about the fall of Jerusalem as the Babylonians destroy Judah. Our context is this. In the previous chapter, we looked at the last two kings of Judah, namely Jehoiakim, who took over for 3 months only in 597 BC at the first invasion of Babylon. He was carried back in captivity into Babylon in 597. And Zedekiah, his uncle, was set up as puppet king of the Babylonians in 597, and he will rule until the destruction of Jerusalem in 586 BC. So that's our context. We start now in 2 Kings 25, verses 1 through 3. In the ninth year of Zedekiah, remember Zedekiah ruled from 597, the first siege of Babylon, and he died in 586, the second siege of Babylon. In the ninth year of Zedekiah's reign, on the 10th day of the 10th month, King Nebuchadnezzar, that's Nebuchadnezzar II, who ruled 605 to 562 BC, King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon advanced against Jerusalem with his entire army. They laid siege to the city and built a siege wall against it all around. The city was under siege until King Zedekiah's 11th year. By the ninth day of the 4th month, the famine was so severe in the city that the people of the land had no food. Now, in these three verses, we see lots of dates. The dates become very precise now because the chroniclers of Israel, of Judah's fall, want to be very careful about the dates and very precise about the dates because they were important. It's just like we remember 9/11 or December 7th, 1941. In America, we do. Now, verse 1 says, in the ninth year of Zedekiah's reign. Well, if Zedekiah starts reigning in 597, the ninth year puts you just around 588. And that's not 586 or 587, the traditional dates for the fall of Babylon. We have to remember here that the siege lasted about a year and a half for reasons we will see. Jerusalem took a while to fall. For one reason, it had a strong wall and it was up on a hill. And for another reason, the Egyptians came up briefly to try to help the Israelites, and that slowed Nebuchadnezzar down a little bit. Now, the Cambridge commentary says it's unknown how long before Nebuchadnezzar shows up, roughly 588 BC when he shows up. How long before this had Zedekiah refused to pay tribute? How long did it take Nebuchadnezzar to get ticked off about it? Well, the Cambridge commentary speculates it was about the 7th year of Zedekiah, which would be about 590 BC, during which time, between the time that he refused to pay tribute and the time that Nebuchadnezzar arrives, during that time Zedekiah tried to shore up the defense of his weak land, all to no avail. Now, King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon shows up on the 10th day of the 10th month, and as the pulpit commentary says, this extreme exactness shows the extreme importance of the date, as I just mentioned. Now, on the Hebrew calendar, what is the 10th month? Well, we assume the religious calendar is being here used, not the civil calendar. The reason I say that is because I checked the other months that show up later, got the 4th month and the 5th month of a later year coming up later in 2 Kings 25. I checked those dates using Wikipedia. There's no controversy on those dates, and they were of the religious calendar, not the civil calendar, so we'll assume that this is the 10th month, which is Tevet, December and January. Nebuchadnezzar shows up. Now, this day, the 10th day of the 10th month, is the exact day that the fate of Jerusalem was revealed to Ezekiel. We read in Ezekiel 24, verses 1 through 2. The word of the Lord came to me in the ninth year, in the 10th month, on the 10th day of the month. That ninth year is the ninth year of Zedekiah we just talked about, which is somewhere around 588. The word of the Lord came to Ezekiel in the 10th month, on the 10th day of the month. That's the same day that Nebuchadnezzar shows up. And this was the word, verse 2, Ezekiel 24, Son of man, write down today's date, this very day. The king of Babylon has laid siege to Jerusalem this very day. So you see how important the exact date is here. Now, why did Nebuchadnezzar move himself to leave Babylon and come to Judah for a siege? Well, he was probably wearied of Zedekiah's treachery and failure to pay him tribute. So Nebuchadnezzar decided to wipe Judah out. Now, Nebuchadnezzar took over from his father, Nabopolassar, when Nabopolassar died in 605, right after the Battle of Carchemish, where the Assyrian Empire was destroyed. Carchemish on the Euphrates River. Babylon, of course, is the most famous emperor of Babylon, or king of Babylon. He ruled all the way from 605 to 562. Now, I'm going to give you a summary of Nebuchadnezzar's operations against Judah by reading to you from Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown. Quote, "Incensed by the revolt of Zedekiah, the Babylonian despot," that's Nebuchadnezzar, "determined to put an end to the perfidious and inconstant monarchy of Judea." This chapter narrates his third and last invasion. The first invasion was 605. Daniel's carried into exile to Babylon. Second invasion is 597, when Ezekiel was carried into exile to Babylon. So this chapter, 2 Kings chapter 25, narrates Nebuchadnezzar's third and last invasion, which he conducted in person at the head of an immense army, levied out of all the tributary nations under his sway. Having overrun the northern parts of the country and taken almost all the fenced, i.e. fortified, cities, Nebuchadnezzar marched directly to Jerusalem to invest it. The date of the beginning as well as the end of the siege is here carefully marked, as I pointed out to you, the dates are very precise, from which it appears that with a brief interruption caused by Nebuchadnezzar's marching to oppose the Egyptians who were coming to its relief, but who retreated without fighting, the siege lasted a year and a half. So long a resistance was owing not to the superior skill and valor of the Jewish soldiers, but to the strength of the city fortifications, on which the king too confidently relied. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown mentioned that Nebuchadnezzar also came after other cities in Jerusalem, in Judea, besides Jerusalem. In Jeremiah 34:7, we read this, "While the king of Babylon's army was attacking Jerusalem and all of Judah's remaining cities against Lachish and Azekah, for they were the only ones left of Judah's fortified cities." So Babylon had come and just wiped out one fortified, as the King James has it, fenced cities, and Judah was in really bad shape, just a rump kingdom now. These two cities, Lachish and Azekah, you can see on a map. If you find Jerusalem, go about 20 miles southwest into the Shephelah, the Philistine plain, you'll see the fortified city of Lachish. That's the same city that Sennacherib, the Assyrian king, in 701 B.C. had attacked in order to try to destroy Hezekiah's kingdom of Judah. That was about a century, a little bit more than a century earlier. And Azekah is about 9 miles to the north-northeast of Lachish, still to the west of Jerusalem. It's about 5 miles to the east of Gath, where Goliath, of David and Goliath fame, lived, the famous Philistine city. So these were the only two cities that were left. Now, here's a speculation by Albert Barnes, who says that the division of Nebuchadnezzar's forces between the three cities, Jerusalem, Lachish, and Azekah, that division of Nebuchadnezzar's army probably invited Hophra of Egypt in, because the Egyptians were allied with Zedekiah. And Hophra says, I got a chance to whip up on Nebuchadnezzar. His troops are divided. I think I'll come in and help the Israelites. We read in Jeremiah 37:5, "Pharaoh's army had left Egypt, and when the Chaldeans," that's the Babylonians, "who were besieging Jerusalem, heard the report, they withdrew from Jerusalem." So now we have troops at Azekah and Lachish, but not at Jerusalem anymore, because the troops at Jerusalem went to help the troops at Azekah and Lachish, which is closer to the road up from Egypt. And so the Egyptians figure, oops, maybe we better not fight the Babylonians. So they withdraw back to Egypt without fighting. We read in Jeremiah 37, verse 7, "This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says," Jeremiah speaking, "this is what you will say to Judah's king, who is sending you to inquire of me." This is what you, Jeremiah, are to say to Zedekiah, Judah's king. "Watch, Pharaoh's army, which has come out to help you, is going to return to its own land of Egypt." In other words, no help from the south. Ezekiel 17:17 says this, "Pharaoh will not help him with his great army, will not help Zedekiah with his great army and vast horde in battle, when ramps are built and siege walls constructed to destroy many lives." It all came to pass, just like the prophet said. Pharaoh heads back to Egypt. Whereupon Nebuchadnezzar returns back to the siege of Jerusalem, and so Jerusalem is still in hot water. Again, we're talking about between 588 and 586 B.C. Verse 2 says Jerusalem was under siege until King Zedekiah's 11th year. Zedekiah took office in 597. 597 minus 11 is 586 B.C. And as I said, the two traditional dates for the captivity, the destruction of Jerusalem, 587 and 586. Albright is 587. Thiele is 586. I like Thiele's better. Most modern sources seem to use 586. And that matches with Zedekiah's reign dates, his 11th year. Verse 3, by the 9th day of the 4th month. Now, Nebuchadnezzar had showed up on the 10th day of the 10th month. Now we're on the 9th day of the 4th month, so that has to be the next year, or at least 1 year later, maybe two. It's probably the next year. Again, it's hard to reconcile these dates. It takes a double doctorate in astronomy to figure all these dates out, and it's way over my head, but I'm going to just assume it's 586 B.C., by the 9th day of the 4th month. When is the 4th month? Well, first of all, the 4th month. The word 4th is not in the original Hebrew. You can see the brackets in my translation, Holman Christian Study Bible. The number 4th is gotten from Jeremiah 52:6, which says, by the 9th day of the 4th month, the famine was so severe in the city that the people of the land had no food. Well, again, assuming the sacred year, the religious year, the 4th month is Tammuz, which is June or July. And as Wikipedia says, there is no dispute that Jerusalem fell in Tammuz, June or July. And they quote Jeremiah 52:6, the verse I just read. So that's why we're on the, how we can know that we're in the religious year, and we have a feel for the dates. So Nebuchadnezzar shows up in our winter time, the 10th day of the 10th month, and the 10th month is Tevet, December or January. The famine continues. By the time you get to June or July in Tammuz, the people are out of food. And that's when, as we'll see in the next verse, that's when the walls were breached on the northern side of the Babylonians came in. Now, this famine that's talked about in verse 3 is described by Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown this way. In consequence of the close and protracted blockade, the inhabitants were reduced to dreadful extremities, and under the maddening influence of hunger, the most inhuman atrocities were perpetrated. This was a fulfillment of the prophetic denunciations threatened on the apostasy of the chosen people. Now, let's read some scriptures that show what happened in this siege. Most of them are from Lamentations. I've got five scriptures. Lamentations 2:20, Lord, look and consider who you have done this to. Should women eat their own children, the infants they have nurtured? Should priests and prophets be killed in the Lord's sanctuary? And of course, Lamentations was written by Jeremiah to talk about what had happened in Jerusalem. And the first verse we read here, Lamentations 2:20, we've got women eating their own children, mothers who cannot think that their child can do anything wrong. They're eating them. It's pretty bad. Lamentations 2:22, you summoned my attackers on every side as if for an appointed festival day. On the day of the Lord's anger, no one escaped or survived. My enemy has destroyed, this is God's enemy, has destroyed those I nurtured and reared. Or actually Jeremiah's enemy, I think it was, has been destroyed. Lamentations 4:9, those slain by the sword are better off than those slain by hunger, who waste away, pierced with pain because the fields lack produce. Lamentations 4:10, the hands of compassionate women have cooked their own children. They became their food during the destruction of my dear people. Ezekiel 5:10, as a result, fathers will eat their sons within Jerusalem, and sons will eat their fathers. Cannibalism, folks. I will execute judgments against you and scatter all your survivors to every direction of the wind. Well, it was prophesied. Of course, we could go back and read the curses in Deuteronomy 28, which I won't do. You get the idea. It was very, very bad. We go now to 2 Kings 25, verses 4 through 7. Then the city was broken into, and all the warriors fled by night. That's the Jewish warriors. Fled by night by way of the gate between the two walls near the king's garden, even though the Chaldeans surrounded the city. As the king made his way along the route to the Arabah, the Chaldean army pursued him and overtook him in the plains of Jericho. Zedekiah's entire army was scattered from him. The Chaldeans seized the king and brought him up to the king of Babylon at Riblah, and they passed sentence on him. They slaughtered Zedekiah's sons before his eyes. Finally, the king of Babylon blinded Zedekiah, bound him in bronze chains, and took him to Babylon. Now, there's a lot of place names in here, and I have personally gone to a lot of trouble to get in my mind maps and places so that when I read this, I don't get totally overwhelmed and confused about what's going on. It's well worth the trouble to do that. And with the internet, it's possible these days. But I'll go through all the geographical places as we go through. We start with verse 4. We see a time indicator. Then the city was broken into. That's referring back to verse 3, the ninth day of the fourth month. Colin Delitzsch says that. And that's when, of course, June or July, Tammuz, the city was broken into by the Babylonians under Nebuchadnezzar. And as a result, they came in from the north. The Israelites went out by the south. They fled by way of the gate between the two walls near the king's garden. Well, the king's garden is right down at the very tip of Mount Zion, which, of course, is on a hill surrounded by two valleys. And the hill has steep slopes down into those valleys. The westernmost valleys is the Tyrrhenian Valley. The easternmost valley is the Kidron Valley. The Tyrrhenian and the Kidron Valley come together to a point at the very tip of Mount Zion, the city of David, and the valley of Ben-Hinnom is at the point. Now, at the very southern end of Mount Zion, you have the king's garden, which was very near the Pool of Siloam. The Pool of Siloam we talked about because Hezekiah built a tunnel from the Gihon Spring, which is on the eastern slope of Mount Zion as it slopes down into the Kidron Valley. And the Gihon Spring was run underground by Hezekiah in Hezekiah's tunnel through the outer wall of Mount Zion into the Pool of Siloam at the southern tip there, right near the king's garden. Now, the Pool of Siloam was guarded by two walls. They had to have a double wall near the southern tip because that Pool of Siloam was the city's water supply. Enemies couldn't get to it because Hezekiah's tunnel ran the water underground, and the spring that fed the Pool of Siloam had the wall around it. And so as a result, the Pool of Siloam was very strategic importance. And so the Israelites, the Judahites, put a double wall around it. And what they had was one wall that ran all the way from Mount Ophel up in the northeast at the southern tip of Mount Moriah. And that wall, well, actually the wall came all the way from the northeastern corner and went all of Mount Moriah and went all the way down the Kidron Valley on the east slope down to the tip and then back up north again on the slope of the, on the edge of the Tyrrhenian Valley. Now, right down there at the south, they just made a little projection of a second wall that intersected the inner wall on the west and east side so that you had a double wall at the southern tip. Now, there was a gate between those two walls that led straight out into the Tyrrhenian Valley. So you had to go from the Pool of Siloam through the inner wall. The king's garden was either in or outside of the inner wall. It's not sure. Then you hit a gate as between the two walls. When it says between, it means between the inner and outer wall, which means it was on the outer wall. You went through that gate to get down into the Tyrrhenian Valley. Or perhaps it was the Kidron Valley, the valley down there in the south. So the soldiers that were left in Jerusalem, they went out through that gate. So now it says the king made his way along the route to the Araba. The king was with those soldiers. The Araba is the Jordan Valley. The Araba is the name for the rift that goes all the way from the Sea of Galilee down to the Dead Sea, past the Dead Sea, all the way down to the Gulf of Aqaba. Very famous geographical landform in the scriptures. And the part of the Araba that the king is in now is the Jordan Valley. Well, he's in the Kidron Valley as he goes east. He goes up the Kidron Valley on the east of Jerusalem. Then he has to branch to go towards Jericho to the northeast overland. I think it's about, I forgot how long, I think it's about 40 miles or so. At any rate, he gets into the Jordan Valley. I don't know what his plan was, where he was planning to go. I don't know how you run from the king of Babylon. But at any rate, he got caught up there near Jericho. And at that point, Zedekiah's army dissolves and scatters from him. The Babylonians catch Zedekiah. They bring him up to Riblah. If you recall from the last chapter, Riblah was an important city on a trade route from the south on up into Syria, up to Carchemish. It was near the Orontes River, which is in Syrophoenicia, between the Lebanon and Anti-Lebanon ranges to the north of Israel. It's about 10 miles, maybe 12 miles or so, south of Kadesh, on the Orontes River, where that very famous battle was fought between the Hittites and the Egyptians. I forgot the year, way in the thousands B.C. I forgot exactly when it was. But Riblah was also where Necho II went after he had killed Josiah in 609 B.C., and then after he retreated from Carchemish, not having beat the Babylonians with the Assyrians, with his allies, the Assyrians, Necho II came back to Riblah and captured Jehoahaz, Zedekiah's brother, and took him to Egypt as a slave. So Riblah was a natural place for Nebuchadnezzar to be because it's on the way from Babylonia to Israel. And remember, to get from Babylonia to Israel, you had to come down from the northeast. You couldn't just march across the desert. You couldn't march straight west across the desert or you would die of thirst. So at Riblah, where Nebuchadnezzar was, having gone there probably after having left the vicinity of Lachish and Azekah, when the Egyptians retreated, Nebuchadnezzar probably went back to Riblah and left his troops, his generals, to carry on the blockade of Jerusalem. And so his troops capture Zedekiah near Jericho and carry him up to Riblah. Verse 7 says this, "They," that's the Babylonians, "slaughtered Zedekiah's sons before his eyes." That ends the dynasty of David, or the future dynasty of David. Zedekiah is still alive. He gets to see that, and then they blind him. Of course, they blinded him in that order so that he got to see his sons getting killed. Terrible experience, I'm sure. Finally, the king of Babylon blinded Zedekiah, bound him in bronze chains, and took him to Babylon. Now, this was a fulfillment of prophecy. Two prophetic declarations, actually, as Adam Clark says. First prophecy was that Zedekiah's eyes would see the eyes of the kings of Babylon. In other words, they were going to see each other face to face. That's first prophecy. And the second prophecy was he's not going to see Babylon, even though he was going to die there. And that means, of course, he was blind. He couldn't see Babylon. Well, let's look at the prophecies that prophesied that in Jeremiah and Ezekiel. Jeremiah 32, verse 4. "And Zedekiah, king of Judah, will not escape out of the hand of the Chaldeans, but he will surely be given into the hand of the king of Babylon, and he will speak with him face to face and see him eye to eye." That happened at Riblah on the Orontes River. Jeremiah 34, verse 3. Jeremiah speaking to Zedekiah, "You will not escape from Nebuchadnezzar's hand, for you will surely be captured and delivered into his hand, and you will see the king of Babylon eye to eye, and he will speak with you face to face, and you will go to Babylon." It all came to pass, just like the prophet said. Ezekiel 12:13. This is Yahweh speaking through Ezekiel. "I will also spread my net over him," over Zedekiah, "and he will be caught in my snare. And I will bring him to Babylon in the land of the Chaldeans. Yet he will not see it, though he will die there." The reason he can't see it is because he's been blinded by Nebuchadnezzar. So these prophecies came to pass perfectly. We go now to 2 Kings 25, verses 8 through 12. "On the seventh day of the fifth month, which was the 19th year of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, Nebuzaradan, the commander of the guards, a servant of the king of Babylon, entered Jerusalem. He burned the Lord's temple, the king's palace, and all the houses of Jerusalem. He burned down all the great houses. The whole Chaldean army, with the commander of the guards, tore down the walls surrounding Jerusalem. Nebuzaradan, the commander of the guards, deported the rest of the people who were left in the city, the deserters who had defected to the king of Babylon, and the rest of the population. But the commander of the guards left some of the poorest of the land to be vine dressers and farmers." Verse 8 says, "On the seventh day of the fifth month," the fifth month is the famous date, that's the date that the city was burnt down. Verse 8 says it was the seventh day of the fifth month, but Jeremiah 52:12 says it was the tenth day of the fifth month. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown reconciles the 2 days, seventh and tenth day, this way. Quote, "In attempting to reconcile these two passages, it must be supposed either that, though he had set out on the seventh, he did not arrive in Jerusalem till the tenth, or that he did not put his orders in execution till that day. In other words, he might have arrived on the Sabbath and waited around for 10 days and then said, okay, we're going to burn the city down. And so the author of Kings says it was the seventh day when he shows up, and he just says he showed up and later burnt the city down, whereas Jeremiah says the actual burning happened on the 10th day. I think that's the easy way to reconcile it. Of course, the pulpit commentator says it's a copyist error and gives a fancy Hebrew explanation for that, which is over my head. Now, the text does not say where Nebuzaradan came from. I assume he was still down around Jerusalem somewhere besieging the city. At any rate, in verse 9, when he got into the city, he burnt down the two big prizes, Solomon's temple and Solomon's palace. He did this on the fifth month, which is Ab. Again, that's the religious sacred calendar, not the secular. Ab, or Ab, is July or August in the English calendar. Now, the walls were broken through on the ninth day of the fourth month, as we read in verse 3. The fourth month is Tammuz. But the city wasn't burnt down until a month later, almost a month later, in Ab, July and August. June and July, the Babylonians break through the walls. July and August, they burn the city down. Apparently, Nebuchadnezzar had hesitated as to how he should treat Jerusalem, according to the pulpit commentary. The pulpit commentary speculates that Nebuchadnezzar probably decided to destroy Jerusalem because of two reasons. One, how long the people of Judah had resisted. It's been a year and a half now. And two, the natural strength that Jerusalem had. Being on a hill, once Jerusalem built its fortifications back up, once Nebuchadnezzar had left, they're going to be a pain in the side of Nebuchadnezzar in the future if they still have that strong city fortified on a hill. So he says, okay, I've had it. I'm going to burn it down. He did this in verse 8 in the 19th year of Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar, of course, took office in 605. You subtract 19 from that and you get 586 BC, which is right when the burning of the city took place. Now, verse 9 says that the commander of the guards, is Nebuzaradan. In verse 8, it says Nebuzaradan, comma, the commander of the guards, comma, commander of the guards is in apposition with Nebuzaradan, so he's the commander of the guards. In verse 10, the whole Babylonian army with the commander of the guards, Nebuzaradan, tore down the walls surrounding Jerusalem. So the walls are down, the temple's down, the palace is down. Also in verse 9, Nebuzaradan burned down all the great houses. That's the wealthy people's houses, the nobles' houses. The pulpit commentator says those houses were purposely set on fire. And the pulpit commentator commentary further speculates that poor houses may have gone up incidentally. Some houses probably escaped, says that commentary, which could then be inhabited by the poor of the land. Well, who knows? The city was burnt to a crisp. Maybe some houses escaped, maybe they didn't. 2 Kings 25, verses 13 through 17. Now the Chaldeans, remember that's the Babylonians, now the Chaldeans broke into pieces the bronze pillars of the Lord's temple, Joachim and Boaz. The water carts, those are the bronze lavers. I think there were 20 of them, 10 on one side, 10 on the other, for cleaning things, cleaning clothes, cleaning utensils. And the bronze reservoir, that's the big bronze sea out in the front, which was also used to cleanse priests' clothing and things like that, used for ablutions. The bronze sea, which was in the courtyard of the priest, which were in the Lord's temple, these things. And the Chaldeans carried the bronze to Babylon. They also took the pots, the shovels, the wick trimmers, the dishes, and all the bronze articles used in temple service. The pots, of course, would hold blood that the animals shed when they were slaughtered, and the blood was drained into the pots. Shovels shoveled ashes out of the altar. Wick trimmers snuffed the candles in the holy place. The lamps on the seven-branched lampstand. The dishes might hold meat as it was sliced up. All the bronze articles used in temple service, maybe hooks that hung meat on the wall, I don't know, but all this stuff is gone. Verse 15, the commander of the guards, that's Nebuzaradan, he took away the fire pans. I think that's a censer where incense is put. Holman Christian Study Bible translates that as fire pans. And the sprinkling basins, whatever was gold or silver, those were the pots that they used to put blood in so they could sprinkle blood, maybe water too, if you needed to sprinkle blood or water. Verse 16, as for the two pillars, that's Joachim and Boaz, the one reservoir, that's the big bronze sea, the 10 bronze lavers that were around the wall of the temple, 5 on the north side, 5 on the south side, All of these were bronze, of course, and they were carried off. Verse 17 says, one of the pillars, these pillars stood at the doorway of at the porch there as you went into the holy place. One pillar was 27 feet tall and had a bronze capital on top of it. That's huge. The capital, encircled by a grating and pomegranates of bronze, stood 5 feet high. That's also huge. The second pillar was the same with its own grating. Now, I went into great detail talking about in the first part of 1 Kings, talking about these pillars and how they were constructed and how they might have looked. So I'm not going to do that again. That was very painful. These verses here, verses 13 through 17 of 2 Kings 25, are exactly the same in Jeremiah 52, contained within the section from verse 7 to verse 23. The only difference is that in Jeremiah, the height of the capital was 3 cubits. Here it's 5 cubits. That actually is fairly easily reconciled. We'll worry about that when we get to Jeremiah. We go to 2 Kings 25, 18 through 21. The commander of the guards, of course, that's Nebuzaradan, also took away Seraiah the chief priest, and Zephaniah the priest of the second rank, and the 3 doorkeepers. He took a court official who had been appointed over the warriors from the city, 5 trusted royal aides found in the city, the secretary of the commander of the army, who enlisted the people of the land for military duty, and 60 men from the common people who were found within the city. Nebuzaradan, the commander of the guards, took them and brought them to the king of Babylon at Riblah. The king of Babylon put them to death at Riblah in the land of Hamath, so Judah went into exile from its land. Verse 18 says that Nebuzaradan took away Seraiah to Riblah, where he killed him. That's the chief priest. Killed the chief priest. He also took Zephaniah, the priest of the second rank. That's the Sagan, S-A-G-A-N, Sagan. The deputy priest is kind of like a substitute, an understudy, in case something happens to the high priest, the Sagan takes over. So Zephaniah the Sagan, wiped out. Now those were the religious officials. Now in verse 19, the secular officials of the kingdom are taken into exile and killed at Riblah. A court official who had been appointed over the warriors from the city, that's Secretary of Defense, to put it in our terms, perhaps. Then 5 trusted royal aides found in the city, 5 cabinet members of Zedekiah. Then the secretary, the commander of the army, that's somebody who was responsible for the head of the army, who may or may not have been the same person as this first person, court official who'd been appointed over the warriors. It's a little bit unclear, but anyway, they were civil officials, and this secretary who enlisted the people of the land for military duty, he was in charge of the census and seeing who's going to be drafted or not. And then also 60 men who were not officials, but they were from the common people who were found within the city, they were also taken into exile to Riblah and killed. Verse 20, Nebuzaradan, the commander of the guards, took them and brought them to the king of Babylon at Riblah. The king of Babylon put them to death at Riblah. Now, all of this painful detail is just given to show the utter disaster that had befallen Judah. The story is also told in Jeremiah 52. There's one little difference. In Jeremiah 52, verse 25, we read this, from the city, Nebuzaradan took a court official who had been appointed over the warriors, 7 trusted royal aides found in the city, but 2 Kings 25 has 5 trusted royal aides were taken and killed. Well, here's 5 possible ways to reconcile those 2 numbers. Clark, in my opinion, has the best way. You take the 5 royal aides mentioned in Kings, add the secretary of the commander of the army mentioned in Kings, and then add the commander of the army himself, and you got 7. And so the author of Kings was just looking at it this way, 5 plus 1 plus 1. Whereas Jeremiah, he looked at it as 7 trusted royal aides found in the city, which included the secretary of the commander of the army and the commander of the army himself. That's the best way, in my opinion. Other ways, here's a way that Poole and Clark give, and Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown. It is probable that there were 5 aides at first who were taken, and that other 2 were found afterwards. And so Jeremiah records what happened after the last 2 were found. Well, maybe so. I don't know. Verse 3rd way to reconcile is given by Poole. 2 of the 7 aides were of inferior rank and are therefore here omitted in Kings, but they were included in Jeremiah by Jeremiah. That's the 3rd way you can reconcile it. The 4th way, it's manuscript error, as Ellicott suggests. Adam Barnes throws his arms up and says, Alfred Barnes, he says, it is impossible to say which number is correct. One of those ways reconciles it, though, folks. The Bible doesn't have errors in it. It's all your presuppositions. If you're going to presuppose that the Bible's full of errors, you're going to look at that and say, oh, it's got an error in it. I can't believe the Bible. It says that Jesus rose again from the dead. I make my decisions as to what's right and what's wrong about the Bible and where the mistakes are. I don't let the Bible teach me. I teach the Bible. We're not going to take that liberal tack. Now, who were these 60 men in verse 19 who were killed who were not officials? Pulpit commentators suggest they were probably notables regarded as especially responsible for the revolt. Why were all these people, the 60 men, the civil officials, the religious officials, why were they put to death? It was probably determined that these men had counseled war against Babylonia. That's typical. You always put to death the people who argue for withstanding a siege. We go now to 2 Kings 25, verses 22 through 24. Now, as for the people who were left in the land of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, had left, he, that's Nebuchadnezzar, appointed Gedaliah, the son of Ahikam, the son of Shaphan, over them. When all the captains of the forces, they and their men, heard that the king of Babylon had appointed Gedaliah governor, they came to Gedaliah to Mizpah, namely Ishmael, the son of Nethaniah, and Johanan, the son of Kareah, and Seraiah, the son of Tanhumeth, the Netophathite, and Jazaniah, the son of the Maacathite, they and their men. Now, I vaguely remember where Maacah is. I'm not going to worry about all these people who Seraiah was the son of. Sounds like he's the high priest, except, well, no, he's not the high priest. The high priest has been killed. This is another Seraiah. This was the rump government in Judah, and Gedaliah was the Babylonian governor. Well, he wasn't Babylonian. He was appointed governor. He was a Jewish guy, appointed governor of the rump government. And Gedaliah has his government in Mizpah. Now, there's about five Mizpahs in my map program, BibleAtlas.org. We don't know what Mizpah that is, but wherever it was, that was his capital. Gedaliah, he's got sort of a Vichy government. He says to all the remainder of the Jewish officials, look, don't worry about the Chaldeans. Live in the land, serve the king of Babylon, everything will go well, but let's don't have a revolt. Let's be good little boys because we just got our rear ends whipped. And that's good advice. No point in revolting if you don't have a chance of winning. Now, who is this Gedaliah that has the rump government in Mizpah? Well, he's the son of Jeremiah's friend Ahikam, who had saved Jeremiah's life. We read in Jeremiah 26:24 the following, but Ahikam, son of Shaphan, supported Jeremiah, so he was not handed over to the people to be put to death. All right, let's look at a little summary, because we don't have the time to go into the detail that we see in Jeremiah. When we get to Jeremiah, there will be more detail about this. But Jameson Fawcett Brown gives a summary of this rule in Mizpah by Gedaliah. Gedaliah, having by the prophet's counsel, probably fled from the city as abandoned of God. He surrendered himself to the conqueror, to Nebuchadnezzar, and having been promoted to the government of Judea, fixed his provincial court at Mizpah. He was well qualified to surmount the difficulties of ruling at such a crisis. Many of the fugitive Jews, as well as the soldiers of Zedekiah who had accompanied the king in his flight to the plains of Jericho, left their retreats and flocked around the governor. So the soldiers who were in hiding had run to Jericho and scattered when Zedekiah had gotten captured by the Babylonians. And then they probably crossed the Jordan, went into Ammon and Moab and so forth, or into the Transjordan Israelite tribal territories. They all went running back to Mizpah. Now, they're not sure, as I said, where Mizpah is. I suspect it's the Mizpah right north of Jerusalem, but nobody knows for sure. So he's got his government going. Now, we can read some passages in Jeremiah to get a feel for what Gedaliah did. Jeremiah 38, verse 2, this is what the Lord says. This is Jeremiah speaking a prophecy from God. Whoever stays in this city will die by the sword, famine, and plague, but whoever surrenders to the Chaldeans will live. He will keep his life like the spoils of war and will live. So there's been a prophecy. Surrender to the Chaldeans. Jeremiah 38, verse 17. Jeremiah therefore said to Zedekiah, this is what the Lord, the God of hosts, the God of Israel, says. If indeed you surrender to the officials of the king of Babylon, then you will live. This city will not be burned down, and you and your household will survive. But, of course, Zedekiah didn't surrender, and the city was burned down. So Jeremiah is speaking wisdom here. Of course, I'm sure everybody thought he was a traitor to Israel, but he was just speaking truth to power. Jeremiah 40, verses 11 through 12, when all the Judeans and Moab and among the Ammonites and in Edom and in all the other lands also heard that the king of Babylon had left a remnant in Judah and had appointed Gedaliah, son of Ahikam, son of Shaphan, over them, They all returned from all the places where they had been banished and came to the land of Judah, to Gedaliah at Mizpah, and harvested a great amount of wine and summer fruit. So there's where all the soldiers, which had scattered after Zedekiah had gotten captured, they came back to serve Gedaliah at Mizpah. Now notice how Gedaliah swore to the people that he's going to take care of them. It will be well with you. He swore to them. So he's taking leadership at a very bad time. But as we're going to see later, he wasn't a good leader. He was a Pied Piper. He led them right over the cliff. We go now to 2 Kings 25, verses 25 through 26. In the seventh month, however, Ishmael, son of Nethaniah, son of Elishama, of the royal family, came with 10 men and struck down Gedaliah, and he died. Gedaliah died. Also, they, that's Ishmael and his 10 men, they killed the Judeans and the Chaldeans who were with him at Mizpah. In other words, the Chaldeans, the Babylonian government officials who had been left behind to rule the former country of Judah. Also, the Judeans who were ruling with Gedaliah, the Vichy government, if you will, to use World War II terms. Well, they all got killed, Babylonians and the Judeans. Got killed by Ishmael, son of Nethaniah. Verse 26, then all the people, from the youngest to the oldest, and the commanders of the army left and went to Egypt, for they were afraid of the Chaldeans. They were afraid that Nebuchadnezzar II is going to look at this situation and say, there's been a revolt. We're going to put that revolt down, and we're going to come after you, and we're going to kill those who killed my officials. This was in the seventh month. This is the seventh month of Gedaliah's government. Well, possibly, but I don't think so. I think it's the seventh month of the sacred year, the religious year, not the civil year, which would be September through October, almost 2 months after the destruction of Jerusalem, which happened, of course, in Ab, which is July and August. So this was almost 2 months after the destruction of Jerusalem, which happened in the fifth month, as I said. The seventh month, by the way, is named Tishri, again, the religious month. Seventh month is Tishri, September and October. Now, Jeremiah has a great amount of detail about how Ishmael, son of Nethaniah, struck down Gedaliah. We're not going to go into a lot of detail about that. I'll do that when I get to Jeremiah. But we can read a summary from Adam Clark. This killing that Ishmael did was at an entertainment which Gedaliah had made for them with this murder. But Ishmael slew 80 more. In other words, he not only killed Gedaliah, he killed 80 other people. 80 more who were coming with offerings to the temple and took several as prisoners. There was no more temple, but I guess they were on the way and they decided to stop at Mizpah since they couldn't get to the temple. Ishmael, son of Nethaniah, took several of these people as prisoners, among whom were some of the king's daughters, Zedekiah's daughters, and set off to go to the Ammonites. In other words, Ishmael is afraid of what the Babylonians are going to do to him for what he did, so he's trying to find shelter across the Jordan River in Ammon, which is due east of Jerusalem across the Jordan River. Go through the tribe of Gad and you get to Ammon. But Johanan, or let's call him Johanan, Johanan the son of Kareah, or Kareah, Johanan the son of Kareah, hearing of these outrages, raised a number of men and pursued Ishmael, upon which Ishmael's prisoners immediately turned and joined Johanan. All right, so Ishmael's fleeing east across the Jordan River to Ammon. He is chased by Johanan, son of Kareah. The prisoners see Johanan coming up in the rear, and they say, we don't want to go to Ammon with Ishmael. We want to follow Johanan. So they leave Ishmael and turn back and follow Johanan, with the result that Ishmael and 8 of his accomplices, with a lot of difficulty, escaped to the Ammonites. Now, why did he go to the Ammonites? Because the king of the Ammonites, named Balis, B-A-A-L-I-S, Balis had sent Ishmael to murder Gedaliah, and Johanan, son of Kareah, had told Gedaliah at Mizpah, hey, there's somebody coming to murder you. His name is Ishmael, son of Nethaniah, and he's coming from the Ammonites. And I can stop that if you want me to. I can kill the murderer who's coming to murder you, Gedaliah. I can kill Ishmael. But Gedaliah could not believe that Ishmael, having been sent from Ammon, could harbor such foul designs, such as murdering him. And so therefore, Gedaliah took no precaution to save his life. And the rest is history. He got killed by Ishmael, having been sent by Balis, king of Ammon. All right, so the former prisoners of Ishmael are now with Johanan, as well as military officials, commanders of the army, all the people, it says in verse 26, from the youngest to the oldest. This would include the daughters of Zedekiah. So now we need to see what Johanan does in this situation. First thing he does, as I said already, he attacked Ishmael, son of Nethaniah. Ishmael fled to the Ammonites. We read in Jeremiah 41:15, but Ishmael, son of Nethaniah, escaped from Johanan with 8 men and went to the Ammonites. I've already said that from Adam Clark. Second thing that Johanan did, he flees to Chimham, near Bethlehem. That sounds so British. Chimham, probably Kimham, near Bethlehem. Jeremiah 41:17, this is Johanan and the little group of ex-prisoners that he has, they left, stopping in Chimham, which is near Bethlehem, in order to make their way into Egypt. So the next thing Johanan does is takes his charges to Egypt, to the city called Tophanes. This is in spite of the fact that Jeremiah had warned Johanan, don't go to Egypt. We can read a long passage in Jeremiah 42, verses 9 through 22, where Jeremiah reads Johanan the riot act, but we'll only choose one verse to give you the flavor. Jeremiah 42:16. Then the sword you, Johanan, fear will overtake you there in the land of Egypt, and the famine you were worried about will follow on your heels there to Egypt, and you will die there. So the little rump of Israel is wiped out. Of course, Jeremiah was in that band too. I should have mentioned that. He ended up going down there, and that's the last we hear of Jeremiah. Jeremiah was the weeping prophet. He had a sad life. The ironic thing about this is Johanan, at least according to the pulpit commentary's opinion, Johanan had no real reason to flee Judah and to go to Egypt. Nebuchadnezzar would probably have known that Ishmael's revolt was personal and not national. I don't know about that. I'm not sure that Nebuchadnezzar would be so discerning, but the pulpit commentary thinks so. But at any rate, Jeremiah, a prophet of God, told him not to go, and Johanan should have listened to Jeremiah. We go to 2 Kings 25, verses 27 through 30, and we will finish this book, this chapter, and this audio. Now, it came about in the 37th year of the exile of Jehoiakim. That's Jehoiakim with an N at the end, not an M, but an N, Jehoiakim. The 37th year of the exile of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, in the 12th month, on the 27th day of the month, that Evil-Merodach, king of Babylon, he ruled from 562 to 560, in the year that he became king, released Jehoiakim, king of Judah, from prison. And he spoke kindly to him, kindly to Jehoiakim, and set his throne above the throne of kings who were with him in Babylon. Set Jehoiakim's throne above the throne of the kings who were with Evil-Merodach in Babylon. Jehoiakim changed his prison clothes and had his meals in the king's presence regularly all the days of his life. And for his allowance, a regular allowance was given him by the king, a portion for each day, all the days of his life. All right, the 37th year of the exile of Jehoiakim is the time frame given in verse 27. Jehoiakim was exiled in 597. You take 37 from 597, you get 560. Lambert Dolphin has 562 to 560 for Evil-Merodach. The Jewish Encyclopedia has 561 to 560. I like that date better because it says, in the year that he became king, Evil-Merodach released Jehoiakim from prison. And so the dates are a little bit closer. 561 is very close to when he became king. 597 minus 37 is 560, which is very close to 561. So the dates are close. Not too much of a harmonization problem there. Now, Jehoiakim, when he was released from prison after 37 years, which is pretty rough, he was 18. 2 Kings 24, verse 8, he was 18 years old when he became king. He reigned for 3 months, and then he got carted off into exile. For 37 years, he's in prison. He was a 55-year-old man when he got loose. Now, one wonders why, after 37 years, the Babylonian king, Evil-Merodach, let him loose. Well, this is somebody's speculation. Evil-Merodach is said to have been put in prison during his father Nebuchadnezzar's reign, and he was a regent, and for some political reason or for some reason, he got thrown into jail while he was regent. This was during Nebuchadnezzar's 7-year illness. Remember when he became, thought he was a cow? And so, I don't know what the historical sources are for this. I'm sure it's a lot of speculation. So anyway, the idea is that Evil-Merodach befriended Jehoiakim in prison, and then when Evil-Merodach got out of prison, he took Jehoiakim out of prison too. Now, this date was a big deal, that the last surviving king of Judah of the seed of David survived. It was a big deal. And so the year is given, 37th year of the exile of Jehoiakim. The month is given, the 12th month of the year, that's Adar. On the 27th day of the month, he was let loose. Now, the day of the month, there's a problem with that because in Jeremiah 52:31, instead of the 27th days, it says here in 2 Kings, Jeremiah says it was on the 25th day of the month that Jehoiakim was released from prison. Here's a couple of options to reconcile from John Gill. It could have been decided by Evil Merodach on the 25th day to let Jehoiakim out, but it took 2 days to finish the process, the paperwork or whatever was necessary to get him out 2 days later on the 27th. Or very similar to that, it could be that they started, the prison officials started to get him out on the 25th, but they didn't get him out till the 27th. That's really not a big deal. Now, Evil Merodach, as I said, was Nebuchadnezzar's son. He was killed in 560 in a conspiracy. And it is speculated that his friend Jehoiakim, the last Davidic king of David that was still alive, it is speculated that Jehoiakim was killed at the same time, which would make him about, what, 58 or so? 55, 56, 57 or 58. He was released in the first year of Evil Merodach's reign. Evil Merodach ruled 2 years. Well, if he was 55 years old when he was released, 2 more years would make him 57, 58 years old, and then kaputsky, he's gone. If that's true, it's not in the Bible. Now, I need to add something here. I am taking an online class with a seminary professor at Greenville, South Carolina Presbyterian Theological Seminary. And this guy, as I mentioned earlier in another podcast, maybe this one, he knows more than Moses does about the Old Testament. I've never seen anything like it, this guy. I hold my breath in awe when I sit and listen to him talk. Well, he was talking about the importance of the Davidic covenant, which of course it is very important. I mean, everybody knows that. But he made this point. He said, the book of Kings is all about disaster, the increasing idolatry and destruction of the southern kingdom, that kingdom which had been promised to David. Descendants were promised to David through the covenant of David. And yet all we see is downgrade, degradation, disaster, destruction. But at the very end, we see a Davidic king who's put on a throne. Verse 28, Evil Merodach spoke kindly to Jehoiakim and set Jehoiakim's throne above the throne of the kings who were with him in Babylon. So there's a descendant of David sitting on the throne, even in exile. And then, of course, when we get to Ezra and Nehemiah, which is coming up in the next audio, we will see the process by which the chosen people of God, the covenant people of God, come back to Zion again. Of course, Zion is the symbol of the new Zion, the church. And the Davidic kingdom survives through Jesus, who was also of the tribe of David. I thought that was interesting. I'll leave it for your consideration. Ladies and gentlemen, we finished the book of Kings. We finished chapter 25. I hope you stay tuned for our next audio when we will turn to the book of Ezra. I'm going to skip 1st and 2nd Chronicles because it parallels 1st and 2nd Kings, except for some portions which I've referred to as I've gone through 1st and 2nd Kings. So we're going to hop ahead to Ezra. I hope you stay tuned for the next audio and hope you enjoyed this one.